Shemtah, which discuss issues of missing husbands, are the final two prakim. In another remarkable, we might call coincidence, the Kollel, with which I'm involved, that year, 2001, was also learning Masechta Yevamos, towards the end of the Masechta, so that the entire Kollel was involved in analyzing these issues that year. I'd like to begin, if you all have source sheets, number 2, page 2, number 1. We had heard a discussion of this source in the earlier session, requiring simanim, requiring certain signs which would indicate and prove that a particular individual has passed away. We will be discussing the specific details. In source 2, we hear the word simon muvok, a clear sign. What does a clear sign mean? Something which is unique to this individual, as opposed to just an approximation. We'll skip the source number 6 for the moment, because that's the primary source for our discussion. The first line, source number 6. Tana Rabbana nafal l'sokiv shana esh me'idin olav. If an individual falls into a fiery furnace, he's presumed to have died, and we can testify that he is dead, even though we haven't recovered his body. This is, of course, the primary source discussing the 9/11 tragedy. So I want to just give some basic factual information. Most of you did not go into all these details, but it's important to know some basics of what actually happened. There were the twin towers, there were two buildings, one the North Tower and the South Tower. The North Tower was hit first at approximately the 92nd floor. Nobody above that floor emerged alive for the simple reason that the airplane crashed into the middle of the building and deactivated all the elevators and severed the stairwells. There was simply no way to get down. Whoever was above that floor was doomed. There was simply no way out. Therefore, if anyone could be determined to have been in that place at that time, it was clear that the individual had died and would be considered to be in the category of falling, being in a kivshon eish. Of course, the question becomes, how do you know that the person was there? I mentioned in the earlier session that the one Talmud that I knew, we had no evidence he actually walked into the building. We'll go into some more details shortly. But there were quite a few individuals who worked for Cantor Fitzgerald. That name was mentioned before. That was a firm that occupied the top floors of the northern tower. And the question became, how do we know that they were really there? So one person worked on the 104th floor, and he called her, a wake-up call, to wake her up at 20 after 8, at a few minutes after the hit. What happens? He called to get his messages, including a message from his wife, at 8:51, and he called her at 8:52. It was also emailed from his office at 8:20, etc., etc. So with the assumption that the email and the cell phone conversations took place, in fact, from his office, and it requires some technical proof that it's really true, because you can email from elsewhere, you can maybe use a cell phone from elsewhere, but there was certain corroborating evidence. It was clear that he was there. Another person also worked on the 104th floor, and his wife called him on his private line in his office at 8:24. So we know for a fact that at 8:24 he was there. This is not a cell phone. This is his private line in his office, which rang only there. At 8:54, he called her from his cell phone. We have this all telephone records. There were also emails. So once again, we assume that he was there. The third victim was on the 103rd floor. Again, all this all Cantor Fitzgerald. He sent her a email at 7:16. There were two witnesses who testified that he always got to his office between 7 and 7:15 every single day. We know he had an appointment at 8:30 that particular morning. So we know, just from that alone, that he was there. It's an addition. In this particular case, they identify the body. This is one of the cases where they identify the entire body from the waist up, and they were here able to identify him through dental records, to which Rabbi Reis referred earlier. There was an additional victim. So these were the victims that were working on the high floors of the North Tower. We had a very dramatic victim. He was on the plane itself. He was on the plane itself that crashed into the North Tower. I believe it took off in Boston and was then hijacked. There were stories which came, people used their cell phones, told a story that there was an Israeli citizen, apparently an army veteran, who attempted to wrestle the terrorists to the ground. And unfortunately, according to the reports, was killed by the terrorists. He was probably therefore the first victim, chronologically, of September 11th. This was this individual whose body was never recovered. If you look in the, want to find sources, look in the Wall Street Journal of October 11th of 2001, that tells this story that he may have been the first victim. The fifth case of the Northern Tower was the student of mine who worked on the 96th floor, just about the place where the attack was. And as I mentioned before, we had, for many months, we had no evidence that he was even in the building. We only had his pattern of behavior. We were able to procure the records from August, each and every day in August, that he went to work, I think, 23 days, when he swiped his MetroCard in Port Authority, and came from a suburban home, and when he swiped a security card in the basement of the first floor of the World Trade Center. We knew exactly how long it took to get from one to the other, based on a pattern of 23 different days. And on that particular day, we know exactly when he placed he swiped his card. It was at 8:12, which means between 8:12 and 8:17 of that morning, he entered into the subway. And we know, based upon the comparison of the entire month, how long it took. We checked with the MTA, the trains were working in order that time, and how long it took to get from 42nd Street down to the World Trade Center station. It's clear that he entered, assuming he went that way, between 8:32 and 8:40, averaging about 8:34, given his previous records. Elevators would come every minute. Took only a minute to get to the 78th floor. It's an important floor. That's where the initial stop was for the express. And then, with the waiting, it would take about 3 minutes. So by 8:45, it's quite clear that he had reached his destination. Again, presuming that he went on his normal pattern of work. And unfortunately, the terror attack came just a minute later. You know, you always wonder if you just would have missed the train. But, you know, this is all HaKadosh Baruch Hu's divine plan. And so therefore, for quite a few months, this is the most difficult case because he wasn't identified in the building at all. However, months later, Pesach time, this happened before Rosh Hashanah, close to Pesach time, through DNA evidence, they identified two bones, one from his shoulder, one from his hip. Of course, they had been found back in the month of Tishrei. It just took him 6 months to sift through all the evidence. And based upon comparisons of this DNA to the DNA that we recovered from what he had left on a toothbrush, it was the chances of a mistake less than one in a trillion. Less than one in a trillion. In this particular case, it was staggering numbers. Staggering numbers. So therefore, this is the summary of the tragedies that took place in the Northern Tower. 3 in Cantor Fitzgerald above the 100th floor. One was on the plane that crashed into the tower, and one who presumably was on the 96th floor at the time of the crash. Now, the southern tower was much more complex. The southern tower, as soon as the plane hit the northern tower, had noticed to run away. As a matter of fact, many, probably most people, as soon as they hit the northern tower, they just ran for their lives. Didn't ask any questions, you just got down. Then, of course, you could get down any way you wanted. The stairs are working, the elevators are working. Everything was working, you just got down. Because nothing had happened. Unfortunately, there were those who told them to stay where you are. And they certainly meant well, because the southern tower at that point was perfectly safe. Once you got into the street, you were subject to the terrible, noxious smoke and fumes. So some people felt it was safer to stay. No one had the power of prophecy. No one knew what was coming next. So many people, in fact, did stay. In the southern tower, the hit took place at 9:02. And incredibly, this is the most mind-boggling of all the parts of the attack, the whole building collapses. We all know it. But no one could have believed it. And the whole building would just collapse on itself. That happened at 9:59. Now, you here understand why it's more complex. The fact that you were on an upper floor did not mean that you died, because you could have come down before any attack. Even if you did not come down, you were on a higher floor, it was a theoretical possibility of escape. Because although the attack which hit at the 78th floor, right where those elevators, express elevators, went 1 to 78 straight, and you went up to the higher floors, exactly at that point where the plane hit, but hit on an angle, knocked out the elevators, but one stairwell remained partially open. We know for a fact that quite a few people who were waiting on the 78th floor were able to get down through that stairwell. So you didn't have the ironclad guaranteed proof, which you did have for someone who was above the 92nd floor of the North Building, was in Kibshon Eish, was no way out. Here, at least in theory, there was a possibility of escape. This makes things a bit more complex. We had three cases that we dealt with. We primarily dealt with eight cases. The other two were just indirectly. One was an individual who worked in the 87th floor. He left his house, we know, at 7:30. And in the time between the two attacks, between 8:46 and 9:02, there was a person who came who worked in the same office. And at that point in time, she was talking to her mother on the telephone. And she said that this individual was with her in the office. So we know for a fact that he was there. But he could have gone out. Interestingly, amazingly, the medical examiner identified his body, but not really his body. We'll get to this in a few minutes. He identified personal effects. What were the personal effects? A pair of pants, a wallet with his credit, the personal credit cards, license plate, and a number of other such things, keys to his house and to his car. Wow. This we'll see soon. That's exactly what the post can speak about. That was that case. Another individual worked in the 85th floor. The company for whom he worked hired a private investigator to make sure that what happened to all those who did not survive. There were at least 8 people who testified that they saw him on the 85th floor, telling everybody, get out. He's one of those heroes. Leave. You know, he was directing traffic. Get out, get out, get out. He, the hero, stayed behind in order to help people get out. And they spoke back and forth on the telephone. And there was at 8:54, we know there was a phone call. We know that a person testified, told him to get out, and when this other fellow went down at 8:55 on the steps, he was still in his office. Apparently he went back, his secretary said, to help save two lawyers who were in a different part of the floor. So we assume he was there. But, because it's a little bit unclear, it's critical, We found DNA evidence from a large bone in his thigh, where the chances of this being a coincidence is almost impossible, even though it was compared to his father's DNA. As we mentioned before, it's a bit of a different. Here, it was less chance than 1 in 10 billion. Not quite a trillion. What, you know, we get these big numbers. 1 in 10 billion, the only chance is that it could be a coincidence. And finally, this, I believe, is the hardest case of all. An individual who worked on the 86th floor. He left his house at 6. We know he got on the bus from his home, I believe is one of the boroughs, at 6:05, and got off at 7:35. We noticed from his colleague was with him. We know someone called him at 8:55 between the two attacks to see if he left the building. He said he's going to try to find out what happened. We have testimony that he went down from his floor, which was the 86th, down to the 78th floor. So we know for a fact he was on the 78th floor. This individual went down in an elevator from the 78th floor to ground level. Less than a minute after she reached ground level, boom, was 9:02, the attack on the Southern Tower. This person believed that her elevator was the last elevator that came down safely before the attack. So that, in fact, if he was on the 78th floor, there's no way he could have gotten down in any of the elevators. However, and here's where it gets tricky, 10 people were saved from the 78th floor by going down one of the stairwells that was still partly clear to get down. It's interesting, though, those 10 individuals apparently were standing near the stairwell at the moment of the attack. This individual is presumably near the elevators. This is in the middle of the building, so it's probably impossible for him to get down. So, I gave you 8 cases. Time is short. I therefore will not even discuss in this year at all reliability in sense of what kind of witnesses do we rely upon. Rabbi Reis already indicated earlier, we rely upon one witness instead of two. We rely upon a woman's testimony. We can rely upon, in certain cases, a non-Jew's testimony. We can rely upon court records and things of this nature. It's quite a complex issue, which we just don't have the time to go into right now. We will therefore focus today, in the brief time left, on assuming that there is reliable testimony to all of these things. Does this testimony suffice for us to declare, based on this testimony, assuming it's 100% true, that the person that in fact died? The most important question, as you mentioned before, is DNA. Is DNA reliable as a Siman Muvuk? Is it less than a Siman Muvuk? Or is it perhaps even better than a Siman Muvuk? That's question number one. Question number two, we just mentioned it before. One individual was identified only by his wallet, or what it contained in his wallet. Do we have to be, and a pair of pants, do we have to be fearful that he lent his wallet out to somebody? Let me ask you by show of hands in this room. Everyone has a wallet, yes? When's the last time you lent your wallet to somebody? I'm glad no one raises their hand. That's very important. We shall see soon in the Shulchan Aruch why that's so critical. Okay. Now, next question. If we know for a fact that somebody was in, let's say, the Northern Tower at 8:30, it was still possible in theory that he went down. In some of the cases, no contact was made. Yes, he was there. He went down to the cafeteria on the first floor. Whatever. Do we have the right to assume that he was at 8:46, where we know he was at 8:30? It's another critical question. Next question, which was already alluded to by Rabbi Reis as well, is a concept called Mayim She'ein Lehem Sof. Someone apparently drowns in water which is boundless. In other words, you can't see from one side to the other. Do we have to fear for the fact maybe he went up the other side? We don't see him here. By some miracle, he survived, held onto a log, and emerged on the other side. We can't see till the end. And the rabbis, in fact, do not permit a woman to marry in such a circumstance for the fear of the somewhat remote possibility that he emerged alive on the other side. How does that affect our situation? And then we have in our case what's called Trey Ruby, two majorities. Because everyone was on the high floors could die in one of two ways. Either by the fire itself, or by coming down to the ground and being crushed in the rubble. So the two separate and distinct ways in which the person was likely to have died. And again, the question which was relevant, do we have a right to rely upon a person's typical pattern of behavior? So now let us analyze this in the brief time that we have and see what some of the correspondence I had with the Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael. My primary correspondence was Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg himself, name I mentioned to you from before. I wrote him a letter, he wrote me back a letter, and we exchanged another set of letters. And this letter, these letters can be found in the Hebrew edition in something called Kol Tzvi, which is printed annually by our Kolel. It came out of Tavshin Samach Beis, in Yoni Mesechta Yevamos, and it says, Kolel Tshuvos Binyan Ha'agunos Me'ason Migdalei HaTa'omim. That's the subtitle over here, which is the first part of this sefer, has my correspondence with Rav Goldberg. And the issue, the fundamental issue, is we'll discuss first, is DNA. On the one hand, DNA is not visible to the naked eye. It's scientific. Is that sufficient? Is that sufficient? Perhaps we should fear that new science will come to a new result. Perhaps we should fear that a mistake was made in the lab. Mistakes do occur. And perhaps most formidably, DNA, in order to reach a level of reliability, is really the combination of 13 different markers on the DNA. Perhaps they considered 13 different simonim, none of which in and of itself suffices to be a simon muvah. Now you run into source number 7. Source number 7. In source number 7, in the Ramah is the lighter print, with the discussion of what's called Simon Muvuk. What's a Simon Muvuk? He had an extra finger, or missing a finger, very, very unusual circumstances. Aval, the line 2, Katan Avarach, he's short or tall, Chiver V'sumek, whatever, he's white, he's reddish, obviously lo havi Simon Muvuk, that doesn't really prove much. And then he has the key line, Vafilu Kuf, even 100, Simonim she'enam uvhokim, enam klum. Vafiru litztarif l'sh'ar umdunas ha'mochikos, enam klum. That a simon she'enam uvhok in and of itself, perhaps, would not even work even in combination of 13 of them in the DNA. Should we consider them to be 13 separate simonim which are not uvhokim? Or should we consider them to be one simon uvhok? A very serious question, a question which is difficult to analyze fully. The Pisrei Tshuva, which I'm not going to quote now, says that the only time we don't combine many simonim she'enim of hakim is if they are what we call their mifuzarim. They're in 13 different areas. But if they're in one place, then we can combine them. If the DNA is in one DNA strand, perhaps we could combine them. This is the fundamental question which I asked Rabbi Goldberg. Very serious question. I mentioned in my question that there were certain rabbis who were hesitant to accept DNA evidence, not so much on real considerations, because they believed in the science, but they were afraid of the negative impact that DNA, if it were to be accepted as reliable evidence in and of itself, might have in other cases, particularly paternity cases. Paternity cases. Unfortunately, there are certain individuals whose halachic status is unclear, nothing to do with aguna. We're talking about mamzerus, cases of infidelity. And the question will become that we have a right, the Gemara has an expression, rovilas acharabal, we have a right to attribute the child to the husband, but not as the DNA evidence to the contrary. And certain rabbis are afraid to go too far out on a limb with DNA, because it may help this particular aguna, but may end up hurting more individuals who would have to be declared as mamzerim. So with that, I raise this question to Rabbi Goldberg as part of my discussion. And again, the emerging statistics, things may change as we go. So Rabbi Goldberg had a remarkable response, and he has a very, very lengthy tshuva, which he penned to me in this edition of the Kol Tzvi, his response goes from page 14 to page 31. So it's about 18 pages in Hebrew, and there's also an English version in this new book that just came out. And I'm going to only read you a very brief part of his response, in which he had what we'll call a comeback. We were wondering whether DNA was a Siman Muvuk, or perhaps not. It was worse than a Siman Muvuk. It was only small, a conglomeration of Simonim, which are not Muvuk. And he said something quite remarkable. Perhaps it's even better than the Siman Muvuk. I'm going to read you part of the English translation, which I think will be more accessible to some of you. Although in the Hebrew, you'll find this on page 25 through 7. In the English, you can find it on page 104 through 6. And Rabbi Goldberg raises the following concept. Aside from a particular Siman, a Siman is a sign. He has an extra finger, missing a finger, he's tall. It's something which we call Tevius Ayin. You see that he died. You recognize the body. So Rabbi Goldberg asks, what do you mean you recognize the body? Maybe there's someone else in the globe who looks exactly like him. So Rabbi Goldberg waxes somewhat poetic. How do we know that everyone's face is different? Did someone travel the world and check every human being and see that no person resembles the other? Rather, we are forced to say that it's based on the fact that we have seen so many different people, and anyone we see does not resemble anyone else. We're not discussing identical twins, though, by the way. They have DNA problems as well as visual problems. Therefore, we must conclude that this is the way the Holy One, blessed be He, created the world, that people's faces would be different from one another. And this is relevant in the Hilchos Hashavas Aveda. We read just yesterday's parsha. Now, the Hashavas Aveda, you're not allowed to give it back unless it's what we call a simin. Right? Again, that's where much of the literature about simin comes in Perek Eilu Metzias, about yesterday's parsha, Hashavas Aveda. But if a Talmud Chacham, if you give it back with Tvius Ayin, once he has credibility, he recognizes the object. He knows that it's his. And Rabbi Goldberg quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph. Therefore, a man is unique. When a person mints coins, they all look the same. When the King of Kings mints people in the same mold as the first man, no one resembles the other. So therefore, this is what we call visual identification. It seems, Rav Goldberg says, the issue of DNA is one of the greatnesses of the Holy One, blessed be He. For even if man was created as an individual, Adam, nevertheless, every person has their own DNA, which is different from anyone else. Quite a remarkable idea. He says that DNA is better than a siman. So we call a tvius ayin. A person has a talent to even draw a nose with amazing clarity. Most people know that the length of another person's nose and the distance between the eye and the nose. They don't measure it, but they're unable to draw it on paper. But in their head, they can visualize it as well. This is the definition of visual recognition. DNA is like the face of a person that the Holy One, blessed be He, made in such a way that there's nothing resembling it. He suggests, Rav Zalman Nechemia, so too with DNA and fingerprints, it's a tvi'ah sign, it's unique to this individual, no one is the same, it's even better than a siman muvuk. This is his big chiddush, which he sent, among many other chiddushim, in his letter which he wrote to me. This is my correspondence, at least one comment from the correspondence I had with this great Gaon. Now, to look at some of the other sources that we have over here, what about the case of the individual who we only identify him by his wallet, by his credit card, by his keys? So if you look in source number 2, Kalev, line 2, the Chayshinon L'She'elo, perhaps we're afraid that he lent the object to somebody else. But in the last line it says, no, Kis the Arniki, his wallet, Menach She'inshi V'lo Mushli, People don't normally lend out their wallets, their credit, they just don't lend them out. And therefore, perhaps this would be a sufficient siman in this particular case. Shulchan Aruch paskins strictly in source number 7, on line number 2. Afal pi sheyesh tam simonim uvhokim biyoseh bekelev, in his personal effects, enam klum, the chayshinon lisha'elo, we're afraid that perhaps he lent them out to somebody else. Source number 8 is a discussion of whether we, source number 9, the chashin l'sheila, afilo arniki, it says in Yevamastav Kufchav, the lo mushli inshi, the people don't usually let them out. Nonetheless, chashinon, right? Because it's not a simon muva gomur. And we're afraid he either sold it or he lost it. Okay, but there are those who say no. Lo chashina l'sheila be'osim kelim adiskarim b'gemara arnik ikis etc. etc. There were those who maintain that we are not worried that an individual is going to lend it out. So it's a matter of dispute, and there were those who are lenient in this regard. I'll take questions at the end. Issue number 3 discusses the idea of what we call trei rubi, that there were two possibilities of death here: the fire itself and the collapsing rubble. So quite a similar case is found here in source number 11. A child from Rab Chaim Ivalozhin. What happened? A person fell off a bridge, which was very high above the ice, and he fell from the bridge onto the ice, and from the ice into the water, and was lost. He couldn't find him. Trei Ruba, the two different majorities. You fall 2 stories from the bridge to the ice, most people will die by skila. Mibis skila, as we mentioned before. Okay? And then, even if you somehow survive that initial fall, nonetheless, you will likely drown in the mayim she'en himself. And they were matter the woman baskomas kol chachme Vilna. All the chachamim of Vilna agreed. Says the end of footnote 11 of source 11, tzaz chidush be'enai shelo hizki divritosus yevamas kufchof aleph the mevua afilud betrei rube lo tinasi lechatchila. What does that mean? So let's take a look back on the earlier sources. We'll see what he's driving at. In source number 4, mayim she'en lemsof ishto asura, his wife may not remarry. Hanimili be'inish di'alma, the average person. Avot surva merabonan lo. But if he's a noted scholar, not. Why not? Idisolik kola islay. If he would have survived on the other side, the word would have gotten around. He's a famous person. But the Gemara ultimately rejects this. V'lohi, lo shna inish di alma, lo shna tuvim mirabonan, the evan in lechatchila lo. Says Tosis in source number 5, even though there is a majority that had he emerged safely, we would have heard about it because he's a Torah scholar. Lo chashinon lo osorov, v'lo tinose lechatchila. She may not marry in the first instance. There is no leniency, even though there's a majority of Mayim Shein Lemsof, the majority of whom don't survive, and the additional majority of a Talmud Chacham, we would have heard about it. And in fact, if you look in Source 6, Mayim Shein Lemsof, Ishto Asura, is Lechatchila. Avali Nosiv, Lo Mafkina, Lo Mineh. If the woman did not listen to the rabbis and she married anyway, we do not force them to separate. Why? Because the majority is that he did not survive. Chazal didn't rely on the majority. So the question becomes, what if there's a second majority? How do we treat this? So I'd like to give you a micro and a macro analysis of this. The first is from Rav Moshe Feinstein, which is source number 12. Let's start this first. L'chei Nochon, it's the end of page 3. Every mayin shel himself, the Hatzala is a miut. Hamotzi, that's a very critical phrase. What do you mean, miyot hamotzi? It is a minority, but it's not so rare. Where's the cutoff point, according to Mishkanus Yaakov? Is it single digits or double digits? If it's more than a 10% chance, it's a miyot hamotzi. Less, it's an eino motzi. So Rav Moshe writes, apparently, imayim shein lemsof, it's a miyot hamotzi that he's going to survive on the other side. That's a chiddush. That's what Moshe says. Aval she nitzol hu mikol makom yenevat zichro. What? He'll survive and you won't hear about him and he'll still be alive? No. That's for sure not matzui. So the question becomes, if that's the case, why are we strict? Why are we strict? So he gives the following remarkable analysis, which is page 4 and a little bit of 5, the final source in this source sheet. We'll start line 2 of page 4. V'tzorech leser eiz zman ad sheyischashev ovad zichro. That's the problem. As soon as he disappears, it's impossible to permit the wife to remarry. Why not? Because the chance of his surviving and escaping and emerging on the other side is a mir tam matzui, which we don't rely upon a rov and a mir tam matzui. After X amount of time passes, whatever it may be, then had he emerged on the other side, we would have heard about it by now, because the communication of yesteryear, the word would have gotten to us by now. That takes much longer. That takes much longer. And therefore we say, unfortunately, that since we had to prohibit the wife initially, then we may not permit her subsequently. Subsequently. That's the pshat in Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof. Oh. So the question will become, what will happen in a case in which is a tzurva merabonim? I'm skipping now to the, just to save time, to the middle of the third and longest paragraph. Yesh kol me'acherim, in the middle of the paragraph, machla shav ragishim behem, b'chol mokom sheyimotzu, shal safek miyud zeh lo osru adayim. In other words, in his case, the word will get back almost instantaneously if he would have survived. So therefore, there were those who maintained that it's permissible for his wife to remarry, because it's a miyot she'en amatsui almost instantaneously. Oh, so now with this, he answers the question, the last paragraph, or next to the last, on page 4. So that's v'nichol afizeh. Many achronim say, trei rubi, she can get married l'chatchila. The question is, it's against the Gemara. Right? That's the question we just saw in the Pisachet Shuvah. So he says as follows. That's a ruba de kola islu. Shanasa achashe kvanesu mitzad rov de mayim shen lem sof. Even though now you want to be matir mitzad rov shenischadesh. There's a new rov came later. We would have heard about it. That's too late. But shanasu atre rubi yachad. Rab Chaim Balazs in his case, he fell off the bridge onto the ice and from the ice into the water. We just read that case. Then, since both roves came about simultaneously, we have a right to be lenient. And therefore, the last two lines. In this particular case, it was in a city where everybody was killed. And even though he was in a different city, all the people in the country mostly were killed. And although some got away, it's a mir shen amatzi. It's a Talmud Chacham of Fursum. V'nevat zichro zekam eshon in page 5. Mizman, this is a Holocaust case. So we have a right to be lenient. Why? Because all of these considerations emerged almost simultaneously. And now he comes with a critical, critical final point on page 5, starting from line 2. Dibizman hazeh. Things have changed now since then. Rav Moshe wrote this tshuva after World War II. Just imagine how things have changed even since then. What happened? There are telephones. Now, and everyone's writing letters via America and Eretz Yisrael. And he has krovim gedolei Torah. He would certainly write to them if he had survived. Everyone wants to know about his family. And there are also newspapers, endless newspapers. Everyone get in touch with everybody else. And he quotes a Chasam Sofer that things had changed already in his time, in the 19th century, how much more so the Rav Moshe in the 20th century, Kolshkin Bismanenu, which is even more, and how much more so today in the 21st century, with all the new cell phones and emails, instantaneous communication. And therefore, the Nazis, the last two lines were there, there was no way to get out, and therefore he permits this woman to remarry. This is Rav Moshe's micro analysis of why this case is different than the case which the Gemara describes. In my correspondence with Rabbi Vadi Yosef, I have to just, since it's a very somewhat long and uninterrupted monologue, let me give you a little bit of personality issues of who I did speak to and try to speak to in the Holy Land. When I was there in that January of 2002, Rabbi Zalman Nechem is very accessible. I went to speak to a man named Rabbi Moshe Halberstam, Zichrono Levracha. Rabbi Moshe Halberstam I had met once before in my pursuing rabbinical endorsements for the prenuptial agreement. He told me a story when I met him. This goes back, I think it was probably 1992 approximately, or maybe 91 or 2. And I had the same meeting happened about 10 years later when I met him about the world. He told me the same story twice. So obviously it was a part of his essence. He said he was a student of the Minchas Yitzchak. Dayan Weiss was the, as you may well know, was first a Rav in Romania. And after the war, he moved to England, and he became the Avezin of the Eda Charedis in Yerushalayim. And in a light moment, he asked to say, Avezin, you know, were you Zoche to become the Avezin of the Eda Charedis in Yerushalayim? And there were other Tamid HaChachamim, I don't want to insult them, but there were other Gedolim who could have, you know, also been chosen by this Eda to be their rabbinic leader. And he answered him as follows. He thought for a minute. I think because after World War II, I devoted so much time and effort in Romania to try to be mater all the Agunas after the war, they should be able to remarry. Perhaps in this chus, I was elevated to the exalted position of the Abbez of Eda Charedis. He told me the story in 1991 or 2, when I was discussing with him the issue of the prenups, which he was very sympathetic to. And he also said the exact same story in 2002, in January, when I spoke to him about the World Trade Center. But he said, I can't answer you, because my Rebbe, you have to go to him. Who's his Rebbe? Rabbi Vosner. Rabbi Vosner. It was very hard to get into him. We finally got an appointment to be to Rabbi Vosner. We spoke to him, we pleaded with him, but despite that, he did not respond in writing. He listened to us very sympathetically, but he felt perhaps that this is in America, he's in Eretz Yisrael. We did not get a response from him. We went to Rabbi Yisrael Yaakov Fisher, Zichrono Levracha, one of the great Gedolim, also from the Badat Eda Charedis. He basically threw us out. He didn't want to be involved in this case for whatever reason. And then Rabbi Vadya. He's inaccessible for two reasons. He's busy, and it's tight security. He has a security detail in his house. So they told me, meet him on Friday at a certain time. So I went, he wasn't there. So it was towards the end of my stay. I remember it was Rosh Chodesh Shvat of that year, of 2002. My last chance to get him was that day to go daven shachris with him. What a fascinating experience, davening shachris in Rabbi Avadya's minyan in Har Nof. I got past the security. I'm wearing my tefillin. Yeah, you guys get into shachris. And it's an amazing shachris. First of all, they say halal without a bracha. This is the minik svard. And other, I'm not going into all the details right now. It was a fascinating experience, not for now. But afterwards, they try to bounce me. The professional bouncers. They're bouncers, no? You ever been bounced? I was being bounced. And I said, I said, Migdalei HaTaumim. So that, you know, I said that. So even the bouncer was a little bit Rachmanis. I went into the Rabbi Vadya's private room. He sits on his bed. He's sitting on his bed. You know, just taking off his talus. He listened to me very sympathetically. And I had two questions. One of the eight cases was a Sephardi who asked specifically if that Rabbi Vadya passed in his case. And two, I wanted answers to him on all the other cases. So I succeeded only part way. Rabbi Vadya wrote me a very long response on that particular case of the Sephardic victim. He ignored all the seven cases of the Ashkenazi. That he left to the Ashkenazi rabbis. Okay. So just to give you a little bit of his wisdom, those who know Rabbi Vadya's style will not be surprised by this. His tshuva, which he wrote to me, is 20 pages. I will only quote one small issue of how he dealt with the issue of Tre Rube, and they count or don't count. So he also went with a similar idea as Rav Moshe, but he macroed it. He said it's like a case of Svek Sveka. Those who know what that means, it's a halachic term. There's one Sufik and another Sufik, we have a right to be lenient. But he says, according to the Ramah, it's only if the two Svekas came together, as opposed to if they came one after the other. So he sounds like Rav Moshe a little bit in this initial stage. But then he goes to a whole different macro. He says, well, this may depend in turn on the fact that we are strict in the case of a suffix. Sveika d'oraisa l'chumra. Is this a din d'oraisa or is this a din d'rabbanan? Which is a well-known dispute between the Rashba and the Ramba. He says, well, the Tosfos that we had in the earlier source that is strict in the case of two roves goes like the Rashba. That Sveika d'oraisa l'chumra is d'oraisa. However, since we follow the Rambam, that the Sveika d'oraisa l'chumra is only with the Rabbanan, therefore we have a right to rely upon a Sveika or Trei Rube, even if they come one after the other. And therefore, in this sort of macro kind of analysis, he comes to a lenient conclusion. And then he says, even though there are some Achronim who disagree, he quotes another macro rule. Whenever there's a dispute with respect to Noshim Agunos, Yesh Lehokel Mishum Takonas Agunos. A very remarkable idea. And yet another macro conclusion from the Truma Sadeshin. Bidiyeved in a pinch. Shapir Domi Lemezel Basa Umda the Muchach Tuva. Which is clear from the general circumstantial evidence, even if it fails to fit into one of the neat patterns that Chazal have been koveya for us. And he says that nowadays, in our world, in such as the World Trade Center, a terrific event, this would also work to satisfy the Truma Sadeshin's criterion, which could be relied upon in the Shas HaDchak. I'm just giving you some other parts of the correspondence regarding the World Trade Center. Rabbi Goldberg, I wrote a letter of clarification to him. He wasn't sure about certain of the facts, which I clarified for him. The most difficult of all the cases I told you was the case of that individual who was on the 78th floor and could have theoretically emerged using that stairwell that 10 people on the floor, in fact, did escape from. There was no DNA, nothing. Just the fact that he was seen on that floor. And I wrote to Rabbi Goldberg in my second letter, and I quote myself in the Hebrew, it's the most difficult case of all. So Bazam Nechemi writes back, he's matir the seven cases like this. The eighth case gets some more people to agree. So, you know, all the Rabbanim, so Rabbi Schwartz agreed, Rabbi Nutter Greenblatt, one of the great sages of America who specializes in Evan Ezemaz, also agreed, and therefore Abezin, in fact, issued letters to the eight widows permitting them to remarry. In two of the cases, as we heard earlier, the chalitza was done in our Bezdin, and therefore the issues were resolved from the pure halachic perspective. I conclude that these are straight halachic matters, which I spoke about dispassionately. That is my charge at the present time. I think that as part of our tshuva process leading up to Rosh Hashanah, Habolein Latova, would be worthwhile for us to delve into some of the more hashkafic and musar and tshuva elements. You can see them not only in this book called Contending with Catastrophe, which recently came out, but I happened to see in some of the things which came to my door, Jewish Action had a whole piece on 9/11 and various magazines, Mishpacha and Ami. I know I spoke with Rabbi Ries about this, and I'm sure that there are other current literature which is available to you, not so much for the strict halacha, which we spoke about today, but for the tshuva and hashkafa shabo. And I hope that each and every one of us will take an important lesson to heart to better ourselves, particularly as we are entering into the Yom HaNoraim, to realize that when we daven in Rosh Hashanah a few days from now, and we say Miyichia Miyomus, and we say Mi Be'esh and Mi Beskila, and we go through it so quickly, we should focus intently that our lives are hanging in the balance, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is judging us on that day what will happen throughout the year. We have a belief that although the World Trade Center tragedy took place on Chav Gimel Elul, that's the yard site, 1 week before Rosh Hashanah, the Gzar Din was almost a year before, on the previous Rosh Hashanah. That's when the Gzar Din, Miyichia Miyomus, and unfortunately was declared that this one would make the train, and this one would miss the train, this one would be fired, and this one would not be. All part of HaKadosh's inscrutable divine plan, which we do not claim to have any understanding. What we do understand is to take the lesson home for ourselves, to better ourselves, to be better people. B'chol eis yiyu b'godecha levanim. Every day, every moment, our garments should be white in preparation for that final moment. When you read in the newspapers about the final moment of one of the victims, when he called his wife and he yelled out on the phone, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, on the phone! And then all of a sudden, boom, he yells out, oh my God. And then we realize what life is all about, how precious every moment of life is. We should use every moment that HaKadosh Baruch Hu grants us well, do tshuva, and thereby be zochet to aksiva v'achasim atova and ishnas chayim v'sholom. If there are any questions, I'll take them either publicly or if you want afterwards privately. Yes?
Was the Avelis, once it was finally done, was it considered Avelis of Shmur?
A very good question about Avelis. An excellent question. We spoke about it this summer in camp. We learned about Hilchos Avelis. You have a right to begin Avelis before there's a psak of the Bezdin that she can remarry. Most of the psakim, if I don't have the exact dates in my mind, Rav Zalman Nechemia asked that we wait 12 months after the original wait, because if you wait 12 months, then there's a question, something called Avad Zichro, which the Mordechai speaks about. So the letters likely didn't go out until approximately that time. There were families who wanted to observe Avelis earlier. It's a big dispute. The Pischei Tshuva quotes that most poskim say no, the Ramosim say no, the Mishkanus Yaakov says yes, in the case of Mayan Shem himself. So we left it up to every individual rabbi to advise the congregants and the families what they should do. Yes?
In the case of the man on the 78th floor, do you take into account the quality of his marriage?
Absolutely, yes.
To see whether he would disappear willingly
right.
or not.
That's correct. I left that part out, but you are right. In each and every one of the 8 cases we wrote in my Shaila, we did research, we found out that we're happily married. Because if someone's not happily married, you never know, he just took an opportunity to run away. And by the way, there was one fellow who ran away and tried to collect insurance claims. So there are Meshugoyim and everywhere, they caught him. But if you think that it's not possible for a citizen to think, it did happen in 9/11, so we have to be careful with this. Yes, sir?
What was the shaila involving the woman who died? You mentioned the middle.
Yes, a woman who died is a Cherem Rabbeinu Gershon. A man may not take a second wife if his first wife was alive. But the evidentiary rules there are much, much more relaxed, because not talking about a potential iser of a capital offense with a potential stigma for the children. So therefore, they were more lenient on the evidentiary levels for that particular case. Yes?
How is it that the Shulchan Aruch is holding on a mafurish of a moral about whether we worry about the wallet?
It's a good question. The Gemara seems to be lenient in certain lit cases, and the Shulchan Aruch seems to be strict. And the Pischei Tshuva said that some are lenient. That's an excellent question, but since I'm already almost 20 minutes late, you'll have to look it up yourself to see the answer. It's a long answer. Not for now, really. Yes?
Are there any longer-term ramifications now that DNA evidence is being accepted at least at a substantial level as far as Hamzeh decision?
That's exactly what I was afraid about. I thought the rabbis would be afraid about. I wrote something quite remarkable. I wasn't going to quote myself, but I was just trying to help the rabbis avoid the terrible possibilities of certain mamzerus, if the paternity, see, if it's not the paternity of the husband, that's not certain mamzerus, because if she lived with a non-Jewish man, the child is not a mamzer. But if you find paternity of the quote boyfriend, then it seems to be there's no way out. So I said, even in that case, there's a remote way out. I admit it's very, very remote. Rav Moshe is a tshuva, that if a woman will accept zera of a donor. This is used for fertility purposes. A donor, then it's not no mamzeris. So who knows? Maybe it came through a donation from that individual. It's quite remote, but I threw it in just to enable the rabbis to be more accepting of DNA as a siman milvik without fearing they're creating mamzerim in the process.
But you're still creating a suffix mamzerim.
You are correct. You are. It's going to be something anyway. Yeah. Yes, Yaakov.
In the Rav Moshe Tshuva mentioned how things might change his contact is much easier to do nowadays. Now, if his culture came that you sell an email, you lose contact with me in a second.
Right.
There's already a few that are gone. So how does that play into nowadays?
Right. Well, that's what I said. That if a Chasam Sofer, Rav Zalman Nechemia said, Rav Avadia said, they all said the same thing. If the Chasam Sofer said that his days would change because there were newspapers and there was letters and postal services, how much more so in the 20th century post-Holocaust, when there are already, much more advanced communication, and how much more so in the 21st century, when it's almost instantaneous communication. So it would have an impact.
Well, there was no evidence whatsoever about that,
thank God we had no such case. We would have said and would have done. I would rather not conjecture. Yes, sir. Right.
But there's several Gentiles who disappeared after the condom because they were very much in debt. Did you check into the debt aspect? Not debt, debt.
I hear it. I heard exactly what you said. That's a very good question.
You mentioned about there's an opinion that the person with love loaned out his purse.
Right.
The person would loan his purse.
Right.
That's old fashioned style. The person will not loan out his wallet with a credit card.
Exactly.
They do not have credit cards.
Exactly. You're 100% right on both points. I will have to ask Rabbi Reese whether we checked out the credit rating of those who passed away. I believe that had
two questions, credit rating, credit card.
Yeah, very good. But had there been a particularly grievous credit issue which would have raised our suspicions, I believe we would have addressed it. I do not believe any such case arose. I will stop now with the public part of the session. Thank you very much for coming.
See you.
For the boys of my shiur, we're going to resume in a few minutes in regular shiur.
Thank you, everyone.